This is Audible.
Recorded Books and RB Digital present The Cast by Danielle Steele, narrated by Jim Frangione. The author begins with the following note. Dear friends, many series that are on TV these days are so much fun to watch and have so many fans who become addicted to their favorites that I became intrigued by the idea of writing about one. There are so many people involved in the production and some terrific actors. And as always, there are underlying themes and subplots in the book as well, one of them being a challenge that many parents face more and more often, the empty nest, with our children taking jobs they love in other cities and moving far away. Often, if your children do well now, it means they got a job they love somewhere else. It can be very lonely once your kids move away and you can't do things together spontaneously. You wish you lived closer to your adult children, but no longer do, and visits are too rare. And for a single parent, it can be a real heartbreak to have children who live far away. We wish them well, but miss them fiercely. It would be wrong to hold them back, so we don't. But then we, as parents, have to face the challenge of filling our time and keeping our lives satisfying and interesting in a city where we once lived with our children and saw them every day and don't anymore. It's an art form for parents to make the best of it, and it can be very challenging. In some ways, this book is about reinventing yourself at any age. The heroine of the novel has a successful career writing for a magazine, and after a chance dinner party she attends, an opportunity presents itself to write a TV series, which opens new doors and gives her fabulous new experiences she never dreamed of before. Suddenly, the void left by her children moving away to their own lives and careers, to San Francisco, Dallas, and London, while she lives in New York, is not so devastating as she explores a whole new career and all it entails. She meets fascinating people, makes new friends, discovers her own talent in a different field, and builds a whole new life for herself. It's an opportunity many of us wish we had, and as the cast unfolds, we discover all the exciting elements of writing and filming a hit TV series, and all the people who are part of it. It sounds like a lot of fun to me. The doors to a whole new world open for the people in the book and for us. I hope you thoroughly enjoy The Cast and all the interesting characters portrayed. Have a great time reading it. I loved writing it. Love, Danielle. To my much-loved, wonderful children, Beatty, Trevor, Todd, Nick, Samantha, Victoria, Vanessa, Max, and Zara, may your lives be full of new adventures, new chapters, new beginnings, with each chapter better than the last. May you give each other strength, remember the good times, and may you embrace life. I love you with all my heart and soul. Mom/DS. And now, The Cast. Chapter 1. The sounds of the office Christmas party drifted into Kate Whittier's office through the partially open door. She paid no attention to it as she sat bent over her computer, trying to finish the last of her work before the Christmas break. It was Friday afternoon. Christmas was on Monday, and the offices of Woman's Life magazine would be closed until after New Year's. She wanted to get her column in before she left, and she had lots to do before two of her children came home on Sunday morning to spend Christmas Eve and Christmas Day with her. But for now, her entire focus was on what she was writing. It was for the March issue of the magazine, but the time of year didn't matter. She tried to keep her subjects of general interest to women, about the difficult issues they dealt with, at home, in their relationships and marriages, with their kids, or in the workplace. The column she wrote was called Tell Kate, and it was hard for her to believe she had been writing it for 19 years. She responded to some letters directly, on particularly sensitive personal subjects, and included others in the column that were of broader scope. She was often cited as an expert, and invited to be on panels about women's issues, or to appear on TV shows on all the major networks. She had majored in journalism in college and went on to get a master's in journalism at Columbia. and a few years after she started writing the column, in order to gain greater credibility and insight, she had gotten a master's in psychology at NYU, and it had served her well. The column was at the front of the magazine now, and many people bought Woman's Life primarily to read her. What had originally been referred to as her agony column in editorial meetings was now a huge success and treated with dignity and seriousness, as she was. And best of all, she loved what she did and found it rewarding. In recent years, she had added a blog to her repertoire that included excerpts from her column. She had thousands of followers on Twitter and Facebook, and had contemplated writing an advice book, but hadn't done it so far. She was mindful of walking the fine line of not overtly giving delicate advice that would leave the magazine open to lawsuits or herself to being charged with practicing medicine without a license. Her responses were intelligent, carefully thought out, sensible, wise, and full of common sense, the kind of advice one would hope to get from a smart, concerned mother, which she was in her private life with her three children, now grown up. They had been very young when she began writing at Woman's Life as an entry path into the world of women's magazines. She had really wanted to work at Harper's Bazaar or Vogue, and agreed to write the women's advice column as a stopgap while she waited for a more glamorous position to open up elsewhere. Instead, she had discovered her niche and her own strengths, and had fallen in love with what she was doing. It was perfect, because she could do the work from home when she needed to, and went into the office for editorial meetings and to deliver her finished columns. When her children were young, it was a schedule that allowed her a lot of leeway to spend time with them, and now she was free to be in the office more, although she did much of her work by email. She had faced many of the problems herself that her readers wrote to her about. Her fans were legion, and the magazine had been quick to realize that they had a gold mine on their hands. Kate could do whatever she wanted at Woman's Life, and they trusted her gut instincts, which had been infallible so far. Caitlin Whittier came from an aristocratic old guard New York family, although she was discreet about it, and had never traded on that fact. And her upbringing had been unusual enough to give her an interesting perspective on life at an early age. She was no stranger to family problems, or the vicissitudes of human nature and the disappointments and dangers that even blue blood couldn't protect you from. She was 54 years old, with striking good looks. She had red hair, green eyes, and she dressed simply but had a style of her own. She wasn't afraid to voice her opinions, no matter how unpopular they were, and she was willing to fight for what she believed in. She was a combination of courageous and quiet, dedicated to her career yet devoted to her children, modest yet strong. In 19 years, she had survived the transitions of several regimes at the magazine. She kept her focus on her column and never played political games. Her attitude had won the respect of management. She was unique, and so was her column. Even her colleagues loved to read it, and were surprised to find many of their own challenges addressed there as well. There was a universal quality to what she wrote. She was fascinated by people and their relationships, and spoke about them eloquently, with a touch of humor now and then, without offending her readers. "Still working?" Carmen Smith asked as she poked her head in the door. She was Hispanic, a native New Yorker, and had been a successful model a dozen years before. She was married to a British photographer she'd fallen in love with when she modeled for him, although their marriage was turbulent, and they had separated several times. She was the magazine's beauty editor. She was a few years younger than Kate, and they were good friends at the office. Although they never got together outside work, their home lives were very different. Carmen ran with a racier, arty crowd. "Why am I not surprised? Figured I'd find you here when I didn't see you falling into the eggnog or rum punch with everyone else." "I can't afford to drink," Kate said, grinning without looking up as she checked the punctuation of the response she had just written to a woman in Iowa who was being emotionally abused by her husband. Kate had sent her an individual response as well, not wanting her to wait 3 months to see her concerns addressed in the column. She had advised the woman to consult an attorney and her physician, and be honest with her adult children about what her husband was doing to her. Abuse was always a hot topic to Kate, which she never failed to take seriously, and this time was no different. Ever since that electric facial you tried out on me, I think I've been losing brain cells, she said to Carmen. I've had to give up drinking to compensate for it. Carmen laughed and glanced at her apologetically. Yeah, I know. It gave me a headache, and they took it off the market last month, but it was worth a try. The two women had made a pact 10 years before, when Carmen turned 40, never to have plastic surgery, and had stuck to it so far, although Kate accused Carmen of cheating because she got Botox shots. Besides, you don't need it, Carmen continued. I would hate you for it if we weren't friends. I'm the one who's not supposed to need any help with olive skin. Instead, I'm starting to look like my grandfather, who is currently 97, and you're the only redhead I know with fair skin and no wrinkles, and you don't own a moisturizer. You're a disgusting person. Why don't you come and join the rest of the office, getting smashed around the punch bowl? You can finish the column later. I just did, Kate said, as she hit the send button to email the piece to the editor-in-chief. She swiveled in her chair to face her friend. I have to buy a Christmas tree tonight. I didn't have time last weekend. I've got to put it up and decorate it. The kids are arriving Sunday. I only have tonight and tomorrow to get the decorations up and wrap the presents, so I can't hang around the punch bowl. Who's coming? Tom and Steph, Kate responded. Carmen didn't have children, and had never wanted them. She said her husband acted like a child, and one was enough, whereas Kate's children had always been vitally important to her and were the center of her world when they were younger. Kate's oldest, Tom, was more traditional than his two sisters, and his goal had been a career in business from his earliest years. He had met his wife, Marybeth, at business school at Wharton, and they had married young. She was the daughter of a fast-food king in Texas, a financial genius who had made literally billions and owned the largest chain of fast-food restaurants in the South and Southwest. He had one daughter and had always longed for a son, and had welcomed Tommy with open arms and taken him under his wing. He brought him into the business when Tom and Marybeth got married after grad school. She was smart as a whip, worked in marketing in her father's empire, and they had two daughters, who were 4 and 6 and looked like little angels. The youngest had her father and grandmother's red hair and was the liveliest of the two. The older one looked like her mother, a pretty blonde, and Kate hardly ever saw them. Tom and his wife were so active and involved in Marybeth's father's life that Tom only saw his mother in New York for lunch or dinner when he was in town on business trips and for major holidays. He was part of his wife's world now, more than Kate's. But he was obviously happy and had made a fortune of his own, thanks to the opportunities his father-in-law had shared with him. It was hard to compete with that, or even find room in his life for her now. Kate accepted it with grace and was happy for him, although she missed him. She'd gone to see them in Dallas several times, but she always felt like an intruder in their busy life. Aside from work in his father-in-law's fast-food empire, Tom and Marybeth were engaged with philanthropic activities, their two daughters, and their community, and he traveled constantly for business. He loved his mother, but had little time to see her. He was on his way to a success of his own, and she was proud of him. Candace, her second child, was 29, and had chosen a different path, as the middle child. Possibly to get attention, she had always been drawn to high-risk pursuits, and danger in various forms. She had spent her junior year in college in London, and never came back. She had gotten a job at the BBC and worked her way up to producing documentaries for them. She shared her mother's passion for defending women struggling from abuse in their cultures. She had worked on several stories in the Middle East and underdeveloped countries in Africa, and had caught various diseases in the process, but thought the hazards of her job well worth it. She was frequently in war-torn countries, but she felt it crucial to put a spotlight on the situations women were in, and was willing to risk her own life on their behalf. She had survived a hotel bombing and a crash of a small plane in Africa, and always went back for more. She said she would have been bored working at a desk or living in New York full-time. She wanted to become an independent documentary filmmaker herself one day. In the meantime, her work was meaningful and important, and Kate was proud of her as well. Of all her children, Kate was the closest to Candace, and had the most in common with her, but she rarely saw her. And as usual, Candace wasn't coming home for Christmas. She was finishing an assignment in Africa. She hadn't made it back for the holidays in years, and was always severely missed. There was no important man in her life. She said she didn't have time, which seemed to be true. Kate hoped that one of these days, Candace would find the one. She was young, and there was no rush. Kate didn't worry about that for her, only about the places she traveled to, which were dangerous and very rough. Nothing frightened Candace. And Stephanie, Kate's youngest, was the family computer genius. She had gone to MIT, gotten a master's in computer science at Stanford, and fell in love with San Francisco. She got a job at Google as soon as she got her master's, and met her boyfriend there. She was 26 years old and in seventh heaven at Google, and loved everything about her California life. Her siblings teased her about being a geek, and Kate had rarely seen two people better suited to each other than Stephanie and her boyfriend Frank. They lived in Mill Valley in Marin County, in a tiny ramshackle cottage, despite their long daily commute to Google. They were crazy about each other and their high-tech jobs. She was coming home to spend Christmas with her mother, and after 2 days was planning to meet Frank and his family in Montana to spend a week with them. Kate couldn't complain about that either. It was so obvious that her daughter was happy, which was what she wanted for her, and she was doing brilliantly at her job. Stephanie was never going to come back to New York either. Why would she? She had everything she wanted and had ever dreamed of right where she was. Kate had encouraged all of them to pursue their dreams. She just hadn't expected them to do it so successfully and so far afield from where they'd grown up, and to plant their roots so deeply in other places and different lives. She never made an issue of it, but she missed having her children nearby. But in today's world, with people more mobile and less firmly anchored, they often moved far away from their families to establish their careers. She respected her children for it, and to avoid dwelling on their absence, she stayed busy herself. Very busy. It made her column even more important to her. She filled her life with work, and was diligent about it, and loved what she did. Kate was happy in her life, and there was a certain satisfaction in knowing she had brought her children up to work hard to achieve their goals. All of them had found rewarding work, and two of them had found partners they loved, who were good people and the right mates for them. Kate herself had been married twice, the first time right out of college to her children's father. Scott Lindsay had been handsome, charming, fun-loving, and young. They had a great time together, and it had taken 6 years and 3 children to figure out that they had none of the same values and very little in common, except that they both came from old, established New York families. Scott had an enormous trust fund, and Kate finally realized that he had no intention of ever working and didn't have to. He wanted to play for the rest of his life, and Kate thought everyone should work, no matter what their circumstances. Her indomitable grandmother had shown her that. She and Scott had parted ways right after Stephanie was born, when he announced that he wanted the spiritual experience of living with Buddhist monks in Nepal for a year, was thinking of joining an expedition to climb Everest after that, and thought that the mystical beauty of India would be a great place to bring up their kids after his adventures. They divorced without animosity or bitterness after he'd been gone a year, and he thought it was for the best, too. He stayed away for 4 years and was a stranger to his children by the time he got back, and then moved to the South Pacific, where he married a beautiful Tahitian woman and had 3 more children. He died after a brief tropical illness, 12 years after the divorce from Kate. She had sent the children to visit him in Tahiti, but he had very little interest in them, and they didn't want to go back after a few times. He had simply moved on, and had been a poor choice of mate for a husband. Everything that had made him charming and seductive in college made him anything but later on, once she grew up and he didn't. He never really had and didn't want to. She was sad for her children when he died, more so than they were. He had spent so little time with them and showed so little interest. They had almost no connection to him. His parents had died young as well, and had no contact with the children before they did. So Kate's children had grown up with their mother as the hub and only support system in their lives. She had shared her own values with them, and all three of them admired how hard she worked, while still being available to them at all times, even now. None of them needed her help particularly. They were well on their way on their chosen paths, but they knew she would have been there for them in a minute if they needed her. It was who she was, with her priorities clear about her children from the moment they were born. Kate's second attempt at marriage had been entirely different, but no more successful than the first. She waited until she was 40 to marry again. Tom had left for college by then, and both of her daughters were teenagers. She met Adrian just as she started a master's in psychology at NYU. He was 10 years older, completing his doctorate in art history, and had been the curator of a small but respected museum in Europe. Erudite, accomplished, fascinating, intelligent, he opened new worlds to her, and they traveled to many cities on museum trips. Amsterdam, Florence, Paris, Berlin, Madrid, London, Havana. In retrospect, she realized she had married him too quickly. She was worried about facing an empty nest in a few years, and anxious to establish a new life of her own. Adrian had endless plans he wanted to share with her, had never been married before, and had no children of his own. It seemed like a good fit, and it was exciting being with someone with such a rich cultural life and extensive knowledge. He was very reserved, but kind and warm to her, until he explained to her a year after they married that his desire to marry her had been an attempt to go counter to his nature, and in spite of his good intentions, he had fallen in love with a younger man. He apologized profoundly to Kate and moved to Venice with him, where they had lived happily for the past 13 years, and her marriage to him had obviously ended in divorce as well. She had been gun-shy about serious relationships ever since, and distrustful of her own judgment and the choices she had made. Her life was happy and satisfying. She saw her children whenever possible when they had time. Her work was rewarding, and she had friends. When she turned 50, 4 years earlier, she convinced herself that she didn't need a man in her life, and hadn't had a date since. It just seemed simpler like this. She had no regrets about what she might be missing. Adrian particularly had taken her by surprise, and nothing in his behavior toward her had suggested to her that he might be gay. She didn't want to fall into someone's trap again, or make a mistake. She didn't want to be disappointed, or possibly encounter something worse. Although she was a great proponent of relationships in her column, they had begun to seem too complicated for her. She always insisted she was happy on her own, although friends like Carmen attempted to convince her to try again, and said she was too young to give up on love at 54. Kate was always startled by her age. She didn't feel it or look it, and had more energy than ever. The years had flown by. She was fascinated by new endeavors, the people she met, and her children. "So are you coming out to get drunk with us?" Carmen asked her from the doorway, looking exasperated. "You make the rest of us look bad, working all the time. It's Christmas, Kate." Kate glanced at her watch. She still had to get the tree. But she had half an hour to spare, to hang out with her colleagues and share a drink. She followed Carmen to the area where the eggnog and rum punch were set up, and took a sip of the eggnog, which was surprisingly strong. Whoever had mixed it had a heavy hand. Carmen was drinking her second one by the time Kate slipped away, went back to her office, looked around, and picked up a thick file off her desk, filled with letters she was planning to answer for the column, and a draft of an article she had agreed to write for the New York Times about whether discrimination against women still existed in the workplace, or was simply a myth and a relic of the past. It wasn't, in her opinion. It was just subtler than it used to be, and it depended on what field. She was looking forward to finishing it. She slipped the file into a tote bag Stephanie had given her, with the Google logo on it, quietly made her way past the revelers with a wave at Carmen and got into the elevator. Her Christmas vacation had begun, and now she had to get busy decorating her apartment for her kids, who would be there in 2 days. She was planning to cook the turkey herself on Christmas Eve, as she always did, and would have all their favorite treats on hand. She had ordered a Yule log at the bakery, and had already bought Christmas pudding from a British grocery store she liked. She had Bombay Sapphire Gin for Tom, some excellent wine for all of them, vegetarian dishes planned for Stephanie, and the right kitty treats and breakfast cereal in pastel colors for her granddaughters. And she still had to wrap all their gifts. It was going to be a busy 2 days until they arrived. Thinking about it, she smiled as she got into a cab for the ride uptown to the Christmas tree lot near her apartment. It was beginning to feel like Christmas, and even more so as it started to snow. Kate found a handsome tree that looked about the right height for her ceilings, and they promised to deliver it later that night when the lot closed. She had the stand she needed, and the decorations and lights. The snow was sticking to her red hair and lashes as she picked the tree out and then walked the 4 blocks to her apartment. People looked festive and happy, with Christmas Eve only 2 days away. She had also picked out a wreath for the door, and some branches she could use to decorate the fireplace mantel in the living room. After she took off her coat, she started to unpack the boxes of decorations she had used for years and her children still loved. Some of them, from their childhood, were a little tired and battered, but those were their favorites, and if she failed to put them on the tree, they noticed and complained. The souvenirs from their early years were important to them. It had been a time filled with love and warmth. She lived in the same apartment she'd had when they were growing up. It was a generous size for New York, and been perfect for them when she'd bought it 20 years before. There were 2 decent-sized bedrooms, one of which was hers, a living room and dining room, a big country-style kitchen where everyone congregated, and, since it was an old building, 3 maids' rooms behind it, which had been her children's bedrooms when they were young, and were big enough for them as kids. The second bedroom next to hers she used as a guest room now when needed, and an office for herself. It had been the children's playroom when they were growing up. She was planning to turn over her bedroom to Tom and his wife while they were there for their brief visit. Stephanie would have the guest room slash office. Tom's 2 little girls would have one of the former maids' rooms their father and aunts had grown up in, and Kate was going to sleep in Candace's childhood room, since she wouldn't be home. She hadn't moved to a smaller apartment because she loved having enough space for her children and her granddaughters to visit. They hadn't all come home at the same time in several years, but they might again one day, and after 20 years she loved the apartment, and it was home. A house cleaner came to tidy it 2x a week, and the rest of the time she fended for herself and cooked her own meals, or picked something up on the way home. With the salary she made from Woman's Life and money her grandmother had left her, Kate could have afforded a slightly more luxurious life, but chose not to. She didn't want more than she had, and had never been inclined to show off. Her grandmother had taught her the value of money, what it could do, how ephemeral it could be, and the importance of hard work. Constance Whittier had been a remarkable woman who had taught Kate everything she knew about life, ideals she still lived by and in turn had demonstrated to her children, although Constance had been less successful with her own children, or maybe just not as lucky. She had saved the family from disaster more than 80 years before, and had been a legend in her time, and set an example for them all of resourcefulness, sheer grit, business acumen, and courage. She had been Kate's only role model growing up. From an illustrious aristocratic family herself, Constance watched her own family and the Whittiers lose their entire fortunes at the same time in the crash of 29. She had been young, married, and had 4 young children at the time, including a new baby, Kate's father, Honor. They had lived in a golden world of enormous houses, vast estates, unlimited wealth, beautiful gowns, spectacular jewels, and armies of help, all of which vanished and turned to ashes in the crash, which destroyed so many lives. Unable to face what would come next, Constance's husband committed suicide. as their entire world was liquidated, and she was left alone with four young children and no money. She sold what she could. They had lost the rest, and she moved with her children to a tenement apartment on the Lower East Side and tried to get work to feed them. No one in her family or immediate circle had ever worked. They had inherited their fortunes. She had no skills other than being a charming hostess, a beautiful young woman, a good mother, and a devoted wife. She thought of taking in sewing, but had no skill for it. So instead she did the only thing she could think of and knew how to do. She made cookies, which she loved doing for her own children. They'd had a fleet of cooks and servants to conjure up whatever delicacies they wished, but Constance had always enjoyed making cookies for her children, when the cook would let her into the kitchen. Her parents' cook had taught her to make cookies as a child, and it served her well. She began making them in the one-bedroom apartment on the Lower East Side. And taking the children with her, she brought her cookies to food stores and restaurants in plain boxes, where she wrote on them, "Mrs. Whittier's Cookies for Kids," and sold them to whoever would buy them. She got an instant positive reaction, not just from children, but adults, and grocery stores and restaurants began to place orders with her. She could barely keep up production for the orders, and what she earned helped to sustain her and the children in their new life, where survival and making enough money to support her children were constant concerns. She added cakes then, and began researching recipes she remembered from Austria, Germany, and France, and the orders kept growing. She saved her money and within a year was able to rent a small bakery in the neighborhood, and continued to fill the ever-increasing orders. Her cakes were extraordinary, her cookies said to be the best. Other restaurants farther uptown heard of her and added their orders to her first customers, and she was soon supplying some of the best restaurants in New York with her baked goods, and had to hire women to help her. 10 years later, she had the most successful commercial baking business in New York, which all began in her tiny kitchen, in desperation to support her children. Her business increased in the war years, when women joined the workforce and had no time to bake at home. Constance had a factory by then, and in 1950, 20 years after she began, she sold the business to General Foods for a fortune that subsequently helped support 3 generations of her family and was still doing so. The trust she had established had provided a nest egg for each of them that allowed them to pursue an education, buy a home, or start a business venture. She had set an example to them all, born of necessity and her own resourcefulness and refusal to be beaten. Constance's sons had proven to be a disappointment to her, only too happy to ride the coattails of their mother's fortuitous success and be idle themselves. She admitted later that she had spoiled them, and one of them had been unlucky. Her oldest son had had a passion for fast cars and faster women, and died in a car accident before he married or had children. Kate's father, Honor, had been lazy and self-indulgent, drank and gambled, and married a beautiful young woman who ran off with another man when her daughter Kate was a year old. Kate's mother disappeared somewhere in Europe and was never heard from again. Honor died a year later, somewhat mysteriously, in a brothel while traveling in Asia, when Kate was 2 and left with nannies in New York. Her grandmother had taken her in and raised her, and they adored each other. Constance's older daughter had been a talented writer, and had written successfully under the pen name of Nadine Norris. She died in her late 20s of a brain tumor, childless and unmarried. And Constance's younger daughter had married a Scotsman, lived a quiet life in Glasgow, and had nice children who had been kind to her until her death at 80. Those children were Kate's cousins, whom she liked but rarely saw. Constance's pride and joy had been Kate, and they shared wonderful adventures living together as Kate grew up. Kate was 30 when her grandmother died at 94, after a remarkable life. Constance Whittier had lived a wonderful life to a great age, with all her faculties intact and a sharp mind. She had never looked back with bitterness or regret over what had been lost, nor resented what she'd had to do to save her children. Constance had treated every day like an opportunity, a challenge, and a gift, and it had helped Kate to do the same in hard times, or when faced with disappointments. Her grandmother had been the bravest woman she'd ever known. She had been fun and exciting to be with when Kate was a child, and even into her 90s. She had stayed occupied until the end, traveling, visiting people, keeping abreast of new developments in the economy, fascinated by business and learning new things. She had learned to speak fluent French in her 80s, and then took Italian classes and spoke it well. Kate's children still remembered their great-grandmother, although the memories were dim now, since they had been young when she died. She'd had dinner with Kate on her last night, and they had laughed and had a lively conversation afterward. Kate still missed her, and smiled whenever she thought of her. The years they had shared had been the greatest gift in her life, other than her children. As she set the Christmas decorations carefully on the kitchen table, she saw a few from her own childhood, and she remembered hanging them on the tree with her grandmother when she lived with her. They brought back a flood of memories, and even though the ornaments were faded now, Kate knew the memories never would. Her grandmother would live on forever in the love and joy they had shared, which had been the foundation of the life she lived. Constance Whittier had been an inspiration to all who knew her, and the cakes and cookies she had baked out of necessity to save her children became household words. The cookies were simply called Four Kids, and the fancy cakes and baked goods were Mrs. Whittier's cakes and had fed them all. General Foods had wisely preserved the original names of the products, which were still popular, and big sellers for them. Constance Whittier had become a legend, an independent, resourceful woman ahead of her time. And Kate still followed her example every day. Chapter 2. Knowing that her children would be home for only a short time, Kate wanted everything to be perfect. The tree, the house, the decorations, the meals. She wanted them to leave 2 days later on a cloud of benevolence and good feelings toward each other. Tom was sometimes dismissive of his younger sister and teased her. She lived on another planet in a world defined by computers, and Tom thought her boyfriend was weird. He was a nice guy, but hard to talk to, and was interested only in computers. He and Stephanie were among the bright lights of Google, and were classic geeks. And Stephanie had often commented privately to her mother that it was strange to think that her brother's father-in-law had made billions selling fries and burgers, and chicken wings with barbecue sauce and secret spices they wouldn't reveal. But Hank, Marybeth's father, was a brilliant businessman, and had been wonderful to Tom, giving him every opportunity to share in his success and make a fortune of his own. Hank Starr was a generous man, and Kate was grateful for the chance he had given Tom. And Marybeth was a smart woman and a good wife. Stephanie was successful in her own pursuits, and had found the perfect mate for her. Kate couldn't ask for more. Only Candace still worried her, with the dangerous locations she went to make her documentaries for the BBC. Her siblings thought she was crazy to do it, and couldn't understand what drove her. Kate had deeper insights into her middle child. Faced with her brother's huge financial success as the crown prince in his father-in-law's realm, and her younger sister's brilliant mind, Candace had chosen a path that made her a star in her own right, and garnered the attention and respect of the world. Her deep concern for the plight of women had inspired Candace to become their voice and champion, and she brought attention to them with her documentary specials, no matter what it took for her to do it. It made what Kate did seem very tame, answering letters from distressed women around the country and advising them on how to solve their ordinary daily problems and strive for a better life. She gave them hope and courage, if nothing else, and the feeling that someone cared about them. It was not a negligible accomplishment, and accounted for the success of her column for 2 decades. Kate was no crusader like her middle daughter, or her grandmother, who had turned a tsunami that nearly drowned her into a wave they'd all ridden for many years. She had been a trailblazer for women, which was unheard of and rare in her day. She had proven that a woman with no training and no skills, brought up to do absolutely nothing except to look beautiful and be a companion to her husband, could actually succeed with the limited resources at hand. Children were still eating and loving her four kids' cookies all over the world. Kate had always loved them herself, although the commercial ones weren't as good as what had come out of her grandmother's oven when she was a child. But they were still delicious and sold well. She occasionally followed her grandmother's old recipes for one of her fancier cakes, particularly the Viennese soccer tort that was her favorite as a child, although Kate made no claim to being a talented baker or chef. She had other skills, as evidenced by her column for A Woman's Life. She decorated the tree that night long after midnight. She put the prettiest, most recent ornaments closer to the top for the adults to admire, and the treasured, sentimental ones of her childhood and her children's on the lower branches, where her granddaughters could enjoy them. She finished, and stood back to admire the result at 3 in the morning, and went to bed with a long to-do list for the next day. She was up and busy at 8 o'clock, and by late afternoon on Saturday, the house looked perfect and she was happy. She went to the supermarket to buy the last of what she needed. She set the table, checked their bedrooms, and spent the evening wrapping their gifts, with a DVD of her old favorite television series, Downton Abbey, playing in the background. The show had gone off the air several years before, but she still enjoyed it, and the characters felt like old friends. It was nice to hear voices in the room, and it gave her a sense of someone with her. She'd watched it so often that she knew much of the dialogue by heart. Her children teased her about it, but she loved the way it was written. It was a family saga that had originated in England with a British cast and become a huge hit in the States by its second year. And the grandmother in it sometimes reminded her of her own. The gifts she had chosen for her family were as varied as they were. She had bought Tom a beautiful leather jacket that was just jazzy enough for his life in Texas, and he could wear on weekends. And she found a handbag and a big gold necklace from a trendy designer she knew Maribeth loved. She'd gotten Stephanie and Frank fleece-lined denim jackets and hiking gear, since they lived in jeans and owned only hiking boots and running shoes. Stephanie always stared in horror at the stilettos her sister-in-law wore. Kate had bought them all books and music as stocking stuffers, and American Girl dolls for both of her granddaughters, appropriate to their ages, with all the accessories that came with them. She'd had a ball buying the dolls a month before, and watched what children their ages were begging their parents for when she picked them. And Maribeth had given her some hints, which helped her. Kate and her daughter-in-law had always gotten along, although they couldn't have been more different. And Kate was well aware that Maribeth had made a concerted effort to turn Tom into a Texan. He wore cowboy hats in Dallas, and had custom-made cowboy boots in every possible exotic skin, from alligator to lizard, given to him by his father-in-law. Tommy had entirely blended into his adopted world, which would have been hard to resist, given the accolades and benefits it provided him. He adored his wife and children, just as his mother had loved him and his sisters as children, and still did. At times, she missed them all fiercely, but she never let herself dwell on it. It was enough knowing they were happy, and she had a good life, too. She followed her grandmother's example, celebrating what she had and never complaining about what she didn't. She opened her eyes on the morning of Christmas Eve, filled with anticipation, excited to see them in a few hours. She tried to call Candace on her cell phone, but couldn't reach her. Kate showered and dressed, put on black jeans, a red sweater, and ballet flats, checked the apartment again, and turned on the tree lights. She was ready. Tommy and his family were arriving in the early afternoon, on his father-in-law's plane, and on Christmas night they would be joining him at an enormous property he had rented in the Bahamas, to spend the rest of the vacation with him. Tommy and Maribeth and the children spent the Christmas break with him every year, after spending the actual holiday in New York with Kate. It had been their tradition since they married 7 years before. Kate was too excited to eat lunch, and read through some of the letters she still had to answer. And after that she updated her blog, which was enormously popular. She had children's Christmas carols on the stereo for Meredith and Lucy Ann. It was Lucy Ann who looked so much like her father and grandmother, and was a Whittier through and through. She was a little fireball with huge green eyes, red hair and freckles, who was polite to adults, but fearless and asked amazingly intelligent questions for a four-year-old. Meredith, Mary was shyer, more cautious, more demure, and very southern. Like her mother, she loved to draw and wrote poetry for school. Both were bright, interesting children, and Kate wished she had the chance to spend more time with them and get to know them better. But the children's lives were so full with school and extracurricular activities that even when Kate was there to visit, the girls hardly had a spare moment for her. A couple of visits to Texas during the year, sandwiched into their parents' hectic schedule, and their annual Christmas visit never seemed like enough. Stephanie had taken the first commercial flight out of San Francisco and would be at the apartment by 3 p.m. Stephanie had no interest whatsoever in marriage or children, and Kate wondered if she ever would. Stephanie thought that marriage was an antiquated tradition that was no longer relevant, and she had never been attracted to the idea of having kids. She preferred the company of adults with similar interests, and Frank agreed with her. They were in love with their work and each other, and there was no room in their life for children. And Candace was light years from settling down with anyone, given her work for the BBC and her own career goals. Kate listened to other women talk about the time they spent with their grandchildren and how much they enjoyed them, but it wasn't part of her life in the same way, or maybe her destiny. Kate regretted that she wasn't as engaged with her grandchildren as her grandmother had been, but she saw them too seldom and for too little time to connect deeply with them. All she could do was spoil them a little and try to get to know them. She was busy with her column and her own life, and her grandchildren felt like someone else's children. When the doorbell rang at 2 o'clock, she was prepared. The moment the door opened, her son hugged her and strode into the room in a suit. Marybeth took off her coat and couldn't stop admiring how beautiful the tree was, and the decorations, and Mary and Lucy Ann danced in looking like little fairies. Lucy was wearing her favorite tutu under her red coat, and she told Kate immediately all about her ballet lessons and the recital she was going to be in June. Kate brought out sandwiches and cookies. She had eggnog for the adults and hot chocolate with whipped cream and marshmallows for the two girls, and they all chattered excitedly as Kate glowed. She loved it when her children were home. Stephanie arrived an hour later, in jeans and hiking boots, and a heavy plaid wool jacket of Frank's she'd borrowed for the trip. She was happy to see her brother as he hugged her, and the two girls were delighted to see their aunt, who was always fun and loved getting up to mischief with them. As soon as she set down her suitcase in her small childhood room behind the kitchen, they came in to bounce on her bed, and she let them. It was a wonderfully warm, cozy afternoon, which they all thoroughly enjoyed, and that night they dressed for dinner. The two little girls wore smocked party dresses that Kate had sent them that looked like the ones their aunts used to wear at their age. Marybeth had on a sexy black cocktail dress, and Stephanie arrived in a white sweater with her jeans, and didn't change the hiking boots she had on, since she had forgotten to bring shoes, as she always did. Tom was properly dressed in a suit and tie. Kate had worn black silk pants and a lace blouse and small diamond earrings that had been her grandmother's and she loved. The conversation was lively at the table, and afterward Kate helped the two little girls set out a plate of cookies for Santa, with a glass of milk, carrots and salt for the reindeer, a ritual they followed every year. Kate helped Marybeth put them to bed and read them a Christmas story, while Stephanie and her brother discussed the new computer system they were switching over to in his father-in-law's business, and she warned him of things to watch out for, which he found very informative. His sister was more knowledgeable about computers than anyone he knew, and he trusted her advice. The adults sat up until long after midnight once the children were in bed. They used to go to midnight mass before Mary and Lucy Ann were born, but they had no one to leave the girls with, and they were too young to join them for church late at night, so it was no longer part of their routine. For now, anyway. And just as they were about to go to bed, Candace called them on Skype. It was already Christmas Day for her, and they all talked to her and caught up on what she was doing and where she was. Tom held the laptop so she could see the tree, and she told her mother that it looked beautiful, and she wished she was there with them. It brought tears to Kate's eyes to see her, and she promised to come to London to visit her, as soon as Candace got back from her current assignment. It gave her something to look forward to, and Candace teased her younger sister and asked if she was wearing hiking boots or shoes, and Stephanie laughed and held up a foot to show her the boots, and they all laughed with her. "I forgot my shoes," she said with a big grin. "Yeah, right. Tell me about it. I don't think you own any. You always borrow mine when I come home for Christmas," she reminded her. And Stephanie laughed harder. "How's Frank? Did he come with you?" Stephanie shook her head. "I'm meeting him in Montana day after tomorrow. He's fine. We're going to spend a week with his parents. His dad's been sick, so he wanted to visit with him." The two sisters didn't talk often, so they took advantage of the holiday call, and they were on with her for half an hour before they ended it. Kate looked nostalgic afterward. "I hope one of these days you all come home at the same time," she said. They had all noticed that Candace was thinner, and the area around her was rugged, but she seemed happy, and she said she'd be back in London for a few weeks, but probably not for long. They were all moving ahead at full speed in their own lives, and Kate had her own. She couldn't imagine what she would have done if she didn't. She would have been lost if she didn't have a job she loved that filled her time, and she was reminded again that you can't hang on to your children, and they're only on loan to you for a short time. After the call, they all went to their rooms and went to bed. Mary Beth apologized to her mother-in-law for taking over her room, and Kate assured her that she was happy to give it to them. She liked sleeping in Candace's old room next to the girls, and she had told them when she went to bed to wake her in the morning, which she knew they would. She wrote letters from Santa for them to find in the morning, along with the stockings she filled with Christmas candy, lollipops, and small toys and little books and things to keep them busy. It had been a tradition with her children, too, like all the others they followed. The apartment was quiet after that, until the two girls pounced on Kate's bed in the morning, squealing with delight over what Santa had left them in their stockings, and she read the Santa letters with them, which praised them for being such good girls all year and assured them that they were at the top of Santa's nice list. When the other adults got up, in bathrobes and pajamas, they opened the gifts from Kate under the tree, because the girls couldn't wait a moment longer. Everyone loved their presents, and Tom and Mary Beth gave Kate a beautiful antique gold heart-shaped locket on a chain with photographs of Mary and Lucy Ann in it. Stephanie gave her a new computer, which she'd had delivered before she came. It was supposed to be state-of-the-art and much better than the one Kate had at home now. Stephanie set it up for her and showed her all the applications she'd added, and she had bought her the latest phone to go with it. Tom and Mary Beth brought out the gifts from Santa that they'd brought with them, and a few from them for everyone. And then they all had breakfast together, went to get dressed, sat in the living room while the girls played with their dolls, and had a casual lunch in the kitchen. The day sped by, and Kate had an ache in her heart at 6 o'clock, when Mary Beth dressed the girls in their traveling clothes, and at 6:30 they left the house, after endless hugs. They were on their way to the airport in New Jersey, where Mary Beth's father's plane was waiting to take them to the Bahamas. Kate sat in the living room, talking quietly to Stephanie after they were gone, trying to fight back tears. In a single day she felt closer to her granddaughters, and then they were gone again. "It all goes so quickly," Kate said softly. Stephanie was leaving at 6 o'clock the next morning. For Kate, Christmas was almost over, and it had been very sweet. "At least we still come home, Mom," Stephanie reminded her, and Kate knew it was hard for them to understand how much it meant to her, and how different her life was without them. Letting go was a fine art she'd had to learn once they grew up, and it was far from easy. Being with them always made her regret again that they didn't live in the same city. Life would have been very different if she could see them any time and have lunch or dinner with them. She had been given back her own life to fill and reorganize once they grew up, and she knew from the letters she answered in her column that it was a challenge other women struggled with as well. One minute you were a family, and the next you were alone, in some cases, although she never whined about it or complained to her children or even her friends. She tried to make it look easy, out of pride and respect for them, but the ache in her heart was almost tangible after Tom and his family left. She never wanted any of them to know how much it hurt to be apart from them. She felt that her happiness wasn't their responsibility, but only her own. She reminded her readers of it, too, and told them to take charge of their own lives and fill their time proactively. "Frank wanted me to spend Christmas with him and his family this year," Stephanie added, and Kate was grateful she hadn't. "But I didn't want to do that to you. I knew you'd be disappointed." "Yes, I would," Kate confirmed to her. "Very much so. Our holidays together mean the world to me." She looked forward to them all year, but she didn't want to sound pathetic to her daughter. "I know, Mom," Stephanie said quietly and patted her shoulder. And then they went out to the kitchen to eat leftovers and talk about how cute Tom's daughters were. Stephanie commented that he was a very good father and seemed surprised by it. "It's so time-consuming. I don't know how he does it." "It's worth it," Kate explained to her. "I guess that's why Frank and I don't want kids," Stephanie said seriously. "It's too much to deal with. I can't see myself ever doing that." "You might feel differently about it later." Stephanie was only 26. "Maybe," she said, but she didn't look convinced. They finished dinner and cleaned up the kitchen, and Stephanie put the dishes in the dishwasher for her mother. "It's so odd in a way," she commented. "I never think of you as old or as a grandmother. You're still so young. It must be nice to have your own life back and have all of us grown up and out of the nest while you can still enjoy it." Kate looked at her and realized how little her daughter understood of motherhood and what a void it left when kids grew up and took off, no matter how young you were. "My happiest years were when you were all young and still at home. I enjoy my life now and my work, but nothing ever compares to that. I guess some people are relieved when their kids leave, but you all spoiled me, and were damn nice to have around," she said ruefully, and gave her daughter a hug. "I was never in a hurry for you to leave, and I love it when you come home." Stephanie nodded, but still had no concept of how much her mother missed her.